My name is Matthew Barton. I'm the curator of recorded sound at the Library of Congress. And just on a personal note, my first ARS conference was here in Chapel Hill in the year 2000. And it was one of those moments where you realize, oh boy, do I have a whole lot left to learn. I became curator in 2008, and that is something that I would not have been able to do without ARSC, so thank you, ARSC. This panel is called Labels and Locals. Tip O'Neill famously said that all politics is local. Well, a lot of the best music and best labels are also local, and our distinguished panelists have all done wonderful work in that area. We are first going to hear from Jay Bruder at my left. And Jay is here to talk about early bluegrass labels. Laying the Foundation is the title for his talk. I do want to add that for those of you who will be driving home tomorrow evening, depending on which...
Sunday evening,
I'm sorry. Way ahead. For those of you who are driving home from this area Sunday evening, depending on the direction that you are taking, you can tune in Jay's program at 7 p.m. on one of two different stations at 105.5 in the D.C. area and 93.5 in the Fredericksburg and Hagerstown area. It's called the Hometown Special, and he plays a lot of the kind of music that he'll be talking about and more. He started that show 18 months ago, and it's really one of the best things that you can listen to. So, without any further ado, I will bring to the podium Mr. Jay Bruder.
Hey, well, thank you all so much, and thank you for tearing yourself away from the coffee break and the goodies in the next room. There'll be some goodies in this presentation. I'll be video and audio goodies. I like to say that there's more than a lifetime of music out there, and today I hope to shine a little light on a dark corner of recorded history, some of the small labels that arose after the Second World War and were able to capture some very unique music. Certainly the bluegrass music that came out in the late 1940s and early 1950s had a very special drive to it, and that's why some folks are really, as we heard in the last session, fanatic about it, because it's powerful music, and I'll play some, I think, very good examples of that. But we are here at ARSC, and it seems of late at ARSC that if you can't dig up a pre-Edison recording, you might as well not even open your mouth. So on the way down, I stopped at a couple different institutions in Richmond, searching for the legendary Polk Miller phono autograph. Okay, no laughs, that's a joke. Because Polk Miller and the Old South Quartet coming out of Richmond recorded some wonderful music, but Polk Miller never made a phono autograph. All right. We are here in Chapel Hill. It's part of that Piedmont Appalachian region that has a wonderful tradition of string band recordings. This is a really iconic photograph since Kathy McBee posted it on the web a few years ago. One of her ancestors was a member of the Motesville String Ticklers from Motesville, West Virginia. They recorded for Columbia, and it's just a wonderful photograph, and it gives you a sense of that community spirit and that community music making, which led into bluegrass. I'm very happy to say that this presentation is not based on tons of original research, because there's been much done from the founding of Bluegrass Unlimited in the early 1960s to the work of the folks at Rounder on the early days of Bluegrass series to many different monographs and then all those wonderful reissue labels that we heard about this morning, whether it's our Hooley or Bear Family or County or any number of them, all contributing to this music over the last 50 years and making sure it was very well documented. There's still black holes, but there's some great music out there. Skip just briefly, we all cite Fiddlin' John Carson's 1923 recordings as the beginning of country music, but I need to remind you that according to the printed sources, the music industry, the record industry, was already in decline. They'd hit an early peak of 106 million records in 1921, and things started to slip through the 1920s thanks to radio. And even though there was the introduction of electrical recording and much improved sound, they still lost ground to radio over those years. And as the Depression hit, things got worse. Not only were they doing labels for Sears and Roebuck and Montgomery Ward, but they started branching out into little five and dime stores, dropped the price of records down into the 30 to 40 cent range. And nonetheless, by 1933, sales had fallen to no more than 5 million copies. That's a tremendous fall from 106 million copies in the previous decade. And it took them many more years to get back up to that 1921 level. One thing that's always fascinated me, and it's an area that needs to be researched, is what I call the cowboy outfit bands. There were tons of them. They were all over the country, and they propagated country music. I don't know exactly what they sounded like because very few of those records have been preserved, or very few recordings of them have been preserved. Here's an example, I think, from the late 20s and from the early 1940s. They certainly dressed well. I hope they could play as well. When we talk about the early days of bluegrass music, no question, you turn to Bill Monroe, the early 1940s, and his work on WSM, both the Grand Ole Opry and some of the other broadcasts from WSM. But sadly, there are very few recordings that survive. A few years ago, one of Dick Spotswood's listeners said, "I found some interesting home recordings," and this was in suburban Washington, D.C. They were cut on paper discs with acetate, and he sent them to Dick to say, "Can you identify them?" Well, it turns out, amazingly, it's Bill Monroe and Clyde Moody. Now, I have to apologize. This is the noisiest thing I'm going to play this morning. This is a paper disc recording from 1942-43 time period. It was in the Washington area, all that humidity, yet it survived. So if you would, this is Bill Monroe and Clyde Moody from WSM, a live air check, probably recorded some 800 miles away from the station.
Come with me, I've got with you.
So moving on from Bill Monroe, of course, you have the outbreak of the Second World War. And that had tremendous consequences on both the performers and the industry. First off, I'd like to talk about the Office of Price Administration, which was put in place to control inflation, to make sure that we didn't have runaway prices. Well, the record industry was hit with ceiling prices. And those ceiling prices stayed in place until 1947. Yes, OPA started loosening up in 1945, but it took a good year and a half before they finally got around to lifting the ceiling prices on records. The other big aspect of World War II was, of course, the record scrap drives, where those rare records from the 1930s were all turned in to be ground up to make new records. And it was a double whammy. One, we lost all of those recordings, some of which have never been found. And in addition to that, all that garbage, all that regrind, went into wartime surplus. And it generally wasn't used until well after the war. So we have records from the late 1940s that sound terrible, not so much because of how they were recorded, but the garbage they were pressed on, because they were pressed on garbage. So we have to deal with that, and that's what has survived. Local radio, however, really flourished, and here are a couple examples, WWNC and WPAQ up in Mount Airy. They didn't so much provide employment for the musicians, although it was employment, but really it was a vehicle for them to advertise their next appearance. And these guys would be out on Friday and Saturday night and then be back in the station at 5:30, 6 a.m. in the morning doing their best for 15 minutes, and that was their show, and that's how things worked. The technology, of course, was instantaneous lacquers, a long-tried tradition, but depending on where these things were cut, whether they were cut on a home machine like the recording you just heard or cut at a radio station with a proper disc-cutting lathe, made a tremendous difference in the quality of the product. Nonetheless, there was an explosion of labels in the late 1940s, and these are just a handful of them. I could put 100 more up there. All of them tried to be everything, and most of them ended up collapsing before the end of the decade. I'm going to talk about five different kind of local labels that had a special role in bluegrass. This label, Richard Tone, and its companion label called Folkstar, is sometimes called the paramount of bluegrass recordings. And the analogy is actually very sad. The performances, by and large, are wonderful. The recording conditions varied tremendously. Some of the best performances were not well recorded, and the pressing material, as I've alluded to, was uniformly awful. So these records are problematic from that sense, but from the performance standpoint, they're great. Here you see a picture of Hob Stanton passing out one of his latest records in the late 1940s. And as you can tell from the different cities he was located in, he had a hard time staying in one place. And eventually the label was sold to a Nashville concern, and then he was totally out of it. But in the meantime, some wonderful music. Early on, he had Wilma Lee and Stoney Cooper, and I think that really helped him get off the ground and financed. And this is a group that really cemented the reputation for Richard Tone. The Stanley Brothers' earliest recordings are on Richard Tone. I find them very dark, you know, very emotionally intense records using old-style harmonies, vocal harmonies, combined with newly evolving instrumental techniques. So if I could, track two, please.
Over yonder stands little Maggie with a dram glass in her hand. She's drinking away her trouble and according to some other man. Oh, how can like two diamonds in the sky.
Okay, some really outstanding performances, which fortunately have been reissued in a couple different formats. Next up, Mutual Records. D. Stone, the fiddler pictured here on the right, had the entrepreneurial spirit to get out there and start making his own records. There were some 16 or 20 different records came out on the label, all of them outstanding. And fortunately, he used a better pressing plant, so they sound a bit better. I'd like to play the Bose Brothers here, Stop Knocking at My Door. Dick Spotswood told me through the research that Gus Mead did, and Dick finished and put in book form, called Country Music Sources, that this song actually goes back to the 1840s, and it was published back then, and then became a standardized minstrel piece. So here are the Bose Brothers with Stop Knocking at My Door. Cut three, please. Next up, Cozy from Davis, West Virginia. John Bava, and I'm happy to say I've been able to talk to his daughter, Janet Bava Williams, and she made sure I was pronouncing the last name correctly, was an Italian-American who worked in the mines in West Virginia, and he also started his own record label. Janet remembers going up on a family trip to New York City in 1946, where her father had contacts at the American Federation of Musicians. And his concept for starting a label in 1946 was to go get union musicians and have them record very stiff pop records, which is how he got things started. Fortunately, very shortly thereafter, he realized there was tremendous talent in West Virginia and focused in on that. He also carried on a very antiquarian practice of giving each side of a record a different number. So there are 500 sides, but 250 records. Okay. He also got into publishing very early, so he was smarter than most in knowing how to do that. Of all the bands that recorded for Cozy, the Lonesome Pine Fiddlers are a real standout. They had started as an old-timey band, but by the early 1950s, they were transitioning into a prototypical bluegrass band. On this recording, Pain in My Heart, you'll hear Bobby Osborne, a very young Bobby Osborne, and Larry Richardson sharing the vocal chores. And this record was successful enough that it was picked up by Coral. Interestingly enough, I've never seen, and maybe Dave Freeman can correct me, I've never seen a regular issue of the Coral, only the promotional issues. So it's a relatively scarce record in either format, but a wonderful performance, and it's been reissued by Bear Family. Next cut, please.
When I first met you right from the start, you knew that I loved you from the pain in my heart. So look in my eyes and see that it's true, and say that you love me, please don't make me blue.
With pain in my heart and blues on my mind, I'll always love you, but can you be mine? Can you be mine with another man's name?
Okay, so that's the style evolving into the early 1950s. Now, coming closer to home, about 2 miles west of here, Noah Adams kept a printing press in his garage. And Noah's daughter, Drusilla, was very interested in music and songwriting. She was good friends with a family called the Church Brothers, who had their own band, and that's how they started their label called Blue Ridge. Within their first year, they were both blessed and cursed to have somewhat of a breakout hit, a Korean War song called Missing in Action by Jim Eanes. And anyone who's been in the record business and not been properly capitalized and not have the distribution connections knows what having a hit early on can do to you. It can be very disruptive. There's a great story that goes with this, and Bill Clifton tells it much better than I ever will, so we ought to ride the gain carefully on this, please. But the next cut is Bill Clifton on my show about a year ago telling the story of Noah Adams and Missing in Action.
Noah told me that a couple of people in business suits arrived one day in North Wilkesboro and invited him to go to lunch. This is 1950. So I said, well, did you do that? And Noah just wore bib overalls, and he didn't dress up to go to the hotel for lunch, but he went with them, and I said, well, what did they have to offer? He said, well, they were from MGM Records, and they wanted to buy the Jim Eanes Missing in Action and just buy the whole label. Well, at that point, he didn't have very many songs on the label, very many artists, and I said, well, what did they offer? Now, keep in mind, this was 1950, $50,000, and I said, no, what did you say? And I said, no, I don't believe I'd care to do that. And I said, why did you say that? And he said, well, I figured if it was worth that much to them, it's probably worth more than that to me.
All right, well, that's an attitude, and I've encountered that in a couple other different places, but that really put them in a bad way because it could have given them the money to properly capitalize the label, which they never really had. Nonetheless, for their 32 or so releases, they had some wonderful talent. Let's hear Larry Richardson again with Happy Smith and his Blue Ridge Boys with Just Let Me Fall.
Let me fall, let me fall, let me fall, you can let me fall.
right. Now, that is kind of the earliest phase of bluegrass as it emerged from Bill Monroe's stylings in the late 1940s into the early 1950s. But things were about to change, and we'll come back home to Chapel Hill. Orville Campbell was a newspaper man here in town, and he knew how to do a business deal. And he started off doing some novelty records. I think his second release was this particular release by Andy Griffiths doing his Deacon Andy routine, where he did this whole skit about football. That came out in the fall of 1953, and I believe it was the next year that Capitol picked it up, and it became a hit all across the country, which gave Orville Campbell some much-needed cash to finance the label for 1955. In 1955, he really starts pumping out the releases. You see the rock and roll things from the next year, but in 55, he's recording Hack Johnson and his Tennesseans with Alan Shelton on banjo. And you'll notice that the sound has definitely changed. So the next track, please. See, you can hear that some of that fire has gone out of the music that was present in the early days. All right, Dick says it has not, but I hear a change around 1955, and there's certainly people to play with the fire today. Yep. All right, well, that kind of does it. I could go on with dozens more labels in this transitional period and then follow-ons into the 45 RPM and the LP era. Happy to say that bluegrass is very much alive and well, even with brand new young bands. But that just gives you a little taste of some of those entrepreneuring labels from the late 1940s and early 1950s and the sound that they were able to capture for that very brief period. Thank you. And Michelle? Just let me change over here, and I'll be right with you. I made a change, didn't I? So I'll save the change. That Little Maggie was taken off the silver label that you saw on the screen, which there were two pressings of that. There was a gold label and a silver label, and that was taken off the 78. Well, that was my mastering, so thank you.
That record was pressed on Connecticut Avenue in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Yeah. Just thought you'd like to know. Not recently.
Well, those late morning pressings were particularly good. Yeah. Okay, thank you, Jay.